From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today is Thanksgiving Day. Some of us spend it with friends and family, others volunteering, and yet others using it as a day of reflection. We asked some people what they were going to do this year.
Thanksgiving holiday. Thanking the Lord for allowing me, for one thing, to wake up and see another Thanksgiving, and thankful for them breathing and on this earth. And because when you wake up in the morning, it's a blessing to be alive. So that's the first thing, praising God and just relaxing a little bit, watching some football and going over family and friends and enjoying a nice meal.
Standardly, I don't do anything. I used to do the traditional thing years ago, but I don't think I've eaten a traditional meal in years. I'm a vegetarian now, so that's kind of changed things for me. Probably just do the, normal social thing in the Mert, there's always a drum circle during the holiday, so I'll probably partake in that.
Mainly, I'm just going to be thankful. I usually look at that holiday as just a time for families to mesh together. I have my own issues about it, but, mainly it's a good time for people to come together and kind of embrace each other and help each other. So mainly, like, our family, we just get together and we cook, have a little food. But now with the Barack Obama election, maybe this time Thanksgiving will be something more of like trying to build something more positive for our communities.
You might remember that we brought you some personal interviews from StoryCorps, which sent a recording booth around the country with its GRIO project to get African-American life on tape. Now, in the spirit of Thanksgiving, StoryCorps is encouraging everyone to set aside 1 hour tomorrow, Friday, November 28th, to record a conversation with someone you love as part of the National Day of Listening. They asked NPR's host to be a part of the project. So to bring a little joy into your life and mine, I spoke with my Uncle Don, who inspires me with his sense of humor and adventure. Donald Stokes is one of the great storytellers in my family, which says a lot. Hi, Uncle Don.
Okay. How are you?
I'm doing great. So the point of all this is just to talk about whatever we want. So since you're someone who inspires me with so many different things, I wanted to start out with just something very simple that you and I used to do, which is go to the track. Do you remember taking me to the track?
Yeah, I spent many days at the track. I used to follow the three big races, Triple Crown, for years.
Taking kids to the track, it's not exactly like your typical, play date type situation. But since you're my godfather as well as my uncle, I guess this was just like this was our version of the play date.
Yeah, but all kids like horses, and, you've got chicken there and something to eat, and you get to watch the horses. That was, a big thing for me.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So do you have a system for betting?
I have many systems, but none of them work, and all of them work. that's the part about gambling. I've seen people pick horses because they had a cute jockey or, the tail of the horse was braided, and they win or lose percentage-wise just as much as someone, spends the night looking at the racing form.
Now, you have all these stories about what it was like to move into the city because you guys were out in Turner Station. And there's a story that probably has gotten told at almost every family gathering about how you and Uncle Vance, your younger brother, got into this epic fight, of course, because the ladies love Cool Don. You got into this epic fight at a party, and you were outnumbered. So tell us a little bit about that.
Greenmount Avenue. We had just moved in the city. We were in junior high, and some girls invited us to a rec dance. We went there. We had a good time until we stepped outside, and a guy said, you were dancing with my partner. So, I like to dance, and I had danced with several young ladies. And I said, your partner, I don't even know who your partner was. And that's when it started. He just hauled off and hit me. And I swung back on him, and that was it. So it was several gangs that were in the city at that time. And us being new, moving in from the county, it was just, one of those territorial challenging things. And, of course, Vance was there. He's 18 months younger than me. We hung out together. That's why we talk about it at family gatherings, because we scrapped among each other because of closeness of age and being boys. But when it came to somebody bothering one of us, the other one had its back. So later on learned that the guy hit had his jaw wired. So it won us a lot of respect. We were going to Clifton Junior High School then. And one of the girls that had invited us, father was an undertaker. He had a small place, March's Funeral Home.
Very well respected.
Very well respected, yeah. They had a little row house at that time on North Avenue. But we fought out there, and we were wearing little barracuda coats, the little trench coats that were something of the time. And I can remember just being surrounded by guys, and you know, this is where you want to be. My back was against the door. They pulled Vance out and by his coat, and I just remember, you know, yelling to him, "Don't go down." And he was down on one knee, and they were pounding on his head pretty bad. So people from inside, the organizers, grown-ups, came out and stopped it, took us back inside. And we had a black Cadillac come and pick us up. And we had to walk through the crowd to get in the car, and we were taken home. So
that's not a bad way to roll out of there.
No, we rolled out pretty good with some bruises and bumps. But, of course, we went home, and we went right in, went right upstairs, and Ma knew something was wrong. So older brother Renzi talked to us, and he wanted to know, "Do you want me to go back there?" You know, like an older brother did. I said, "No, I think we did okay with a little headache and little aches and pains." And we found out when we went to school that week that we didn't have to join any gangs, but we had a bunch of respect.
That's a tough way to jump in. But, you know, it reminds me a little bit about the stories that you've told being jumped in on the ship Coast and Geodetic Survey. First, for people who don't know what it is, explain what the Coast and Geodetic Survey is.
It's the map makers, the people that go out and survey the ocean. So it's basically oceanography. And myself, going to a technical school, Poly, I was recruited right out of there because I had surveying in school. The program was to lead to a commission officer in the Coast and Geodetic Survey. And, of course, they said you would travel. So, you know me, I wanted to travel.
And where were a couple of the places you went?
We normally surveyed the coastline up and down the West Coast. The second year, we went to a joint ocean adventure, the Indian Ocean Expedition. And there I went to the Philippines, Jakarta, Malaysia, Singapore, India, with Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, Penang, Midway, all the ports between California and India and back.
You also learned to do karate while you were on that ship, right?
I hung out with a bunch of guys from the islands, Hawaiian guys, and that's where I first heard of Ed Parker. And I started talking to him and the philosophy and how they had to take care of themselves. And we would punch the metal sidings around the quarterdeck, toughen up our hands. And, of course, they showed me a few things. Why I got started, I was with a bunch of Hawaiian guys, and we were on Waikiki, and there was a little Chinese guy that didn't sail with us, but a couple, I guess, mainlanders were bothering him. And he tried to walk away several times, and they caught up with him. And then it was like in a flash, and it was over with. You know, all these guys were like on the ground, and I said, what was that? And that was, of course, some kung fu. And Ed Parker teaches kung fu on the street side.
And Ed Parker went on to become one of the best-known names in martial arts.
Right. He was known as the father of American karate. And, in fact, he housed Bruce Lee when he first came over here. Bruce Lee stayed with Mr. Parker. And I got to see Bruce Lee in California at a demo. But he had a young guy there, a Chinese guy, who was going to show us one-inch punch, which Bruce Lee, you know, later on I became famous for. But it, a guy from the audience came up and Bruce put his fist about an inch from his chest, and then he told him you put a chair behind him because he was going to be sitting down. And he punched this guy from an extended arm, just, you know, generated the kind of force that set this guy in a chair and slid across the floor. So we had some good, I mean, some really good times and really impressive. And to talk to any of these people, you know, it was they were very interesting people to talk about. They really studied the mechanics of the art.
Well, I'm going to have to leave it there. There's so many things that I find interesting about you, and that means that the next time I get to see you guys over the holidays, I expect more stories.
Yeah, well, I always have a few.
You have more than a few, and these are just the ones that we can put on the radio.
I know I'm working on some right now.
Okay. Uncle Don, right. Lots of love. You take care.
You too. Bye now.
Bye. That was my Uncle Donald Stokes talking about some of his adventures around the world. He also went on to serve as a U.S. Marine. He spoke to me from the studios of WEAA in Baltimore, Maryland. And you're getting to hear this as part of the StoryCorps National Day of Listening. If you're interested in recording someone important to you, StoryCorps has all the resources you need to get started. Just go to nationaldayoflistening.org, where you'll find a downloadable do-it-yourself guide, great questions, and an instructional video. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Thanksgiving is about the family, but it's also about food. We've got ace chef Giada De Laurentiis, who has hosted on the Food Network many shows, including Everyday Italian, with us. Her new show is Giada at Home. It premiered last month. She's also the author of several cookbooks, most recently Giada's Kitchen, New Italian Favorites. Welcome.
Hi.
So you are someone who has so many different parts of your empire, but they all come down to something which is essential to human life, which is to cook and to eat and to share. How did you get into taking something that clearly is a passion and turning it into, you know, who you are as a force in the world?
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people have asked me that question at this point because food has exploded. And although it's obviously been a big part of everybody's life forever, we need it to sustain life, it's now become part of our culture in a way that for me growing up in an Italian family, it always was a big part of our culture. But coming to America when I was 8 years old, it wasn't such a big part of the American culture. And now it's become a really big part of it. And it's so fantastic. It makes me so happy to see everybody really enjoying food. Because I'm from a large Italian family and because everything surrounded our meals, everything happened in the kitchen or around the table sharing food, I grew up with a passion. Now, my family is in the movie business and has been for a long time. I decided that I wanted to kind of do something a little different and go back to our roots and really spend time learning to cook. And never could I have imagined where I would be today. I don't think anybody could have, certainly nobody in my family. So I don't know where the ride goes, but it's been a great one so far.
You do this turkey where I'm watching your show and you do a turkey with a little bit of a crust, and people can be very traditional about their food. And how did you decide to go about doing that particular dish?
You know, it's interesting. I've been doing Thanksgiving now for, 6 years on the Food Network? And every Thanksgiving, you want to make it a little different. You don't want to give them the same stuff every year. So I know people are kind of sticklers to a certain type of menu when it comes to the holidays. Every year they do the same thing. But I tell people it's fun to break out of that mold every once in a while. Do something a little different. And I found that in my family, most people eat the breast. So this year I said, you know what? The heck with doing a whole turkey and spending hours and hours on the whole turkey when most people just eat the breast. So I took the turkey breast and I thought, the warm spices of Thanksgiving or the holidays, what reminds me of the holidays is the cinnamon, it's the cumin, it's the allspice, it's a little brown sugar to make it slightly sweet. So I created this crust mixed in with mustard, and I put it on the turkey. So when it bakes, it sort of goes into the actual turkey, infuses it with all the flavors and the aromas of the holidays, and creates a little crust. So you get this little, like, spicy, sugary crust on top of the turkey, which I think is fantastic.
It's definitely something where I'm sure a lot of people would be not just surprised by it, but also possibly intimidated by it. So if you find someone who is a friend, a family member, or just someone who knows you from all the work you've done and who's like, I can't do that. I'm going to mess it up. What do you say to people who are afraid of cooking?
What people said to me in the beginning when I started doing Everyday Italian was, great Italian food can only be had in a restaurant. You can't recreate it at home. It's too difficult. And I said, you know, but for years and forever, my family's always been making it at home. It can be done. It's simple. And I always say to people, if you're fearful of cooking, start by assembling. Don't cook anything. Just get a bunch of ingredients, like, for instance, a caprese salad, some great mozzarella, some fabulous tomatoes, and some great basil. Drizzle a little extra virgin olive oil, really good stuff, and some salt. And just assemble things first so that you gain that confidence in the kitchen. And once you've assembled some great dishes and you see the excitement on your family, your friends, your boyfriend, your husband, whoever's faces, you will gain the confidence little by little to start actually cooking.
How do you eat?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I would never say that I'm a diet chef. I don't do diet recipes. I do like to eat healthy food, healthy, clean, good food. There are some recipes that you can trim down the fat and they're still fantastic. There are others of them that you just can't. You just can't do it. So you either make them once in a while and eat a small portion, or you don't make them and you don't eat them. I truly believe in balance in my life. So, yes, I like to eat healthy and light, but there's days where I'm craving, you know, I love pasta bechamel, which is a cream sauce filled with cream, butter, cheese baked in the oven. There's days that nothing else will take the place of that. So I need it and I crave it and I eat it. But I think it's really about portion control and a balance in life. Don't ever tell yourself you can't have something, because the minute you tell yourself you can't have it, that's all you want.
Buying food, a lot of people have started to go to farmers markets who might not have 5 or 10 years ago. It's become a little bit trendy, and then also sometimes you can save money, and these are times when a lot of people want to save money. Where do you shop to buy your food?
I shop at a lot of different places. Farmers markets, number one. Thank goodness now there are farmers markets across the country, so we can actually, in our programs, talk about the farmers market, because a lot of times in the past we could not. Because living in California, we get a lot of farmers markets, but people across the country did not. So now it's spread throughout the country, which is wonderful. I shop at all different types of stores here in California, Whole Foods. For certain things, I go to the fish market for fish. So I do what Europeans do, go to different places to get different things.
Let's go back to Thanksgiving. We already talked about your turkey breast with a crust. Give me one or two other things that you think really should go with Thanksgiving.
Well, I think my husband would agree that he would not like Thanksgiving without potatoes of some kind. And I think a lot of people feel that way. So my Aunt Raffi does this fantastic potato dish. Take the potatoes and mash them, make mashed potatoes, put them in a casserole dish. We put peas in the center and lots of mozzarella and Parmesan cheese mixed into the potatoes, and top it with a little bit of breadcrumbs and stick it in the oven. So you get this like crust on top of the potatoes, and then inside they're fluffy and light, and then a little bit of peas in the center, because not everybody in my family likes peas. So you know that if you want peas, you're going straight in the middle of the casserole, and if you don't, you go to the sides.
That is very funny. What about dessert? Give me a dessert for the holidays that you love.
One of my favorite ones is this cornmeal and rosemary cake. So we use polenta cornmeal and a little bit of rosemary, and you bake it. It becomes basically like a pound cake. Okay, it's buttery and rich. It's the holidays. That happens. Sometimes I stud it with some cranberries for some color. Other times I do not. Depends on my mood. And then I top it with a balsamic syrup. So I reduce balsamic, gets nice and thick like a chocolate sauce, and then I pour it over the top. I can't tell you. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, whatever, snack, it is phenomenal. It's one of those things I keep in my house during the holidays.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
So you're a mother now, and your baby's first Christmas is coming up.
Yes.
How's
yes.
that going to affect you to have someone, a little tiny one, to take through the holidays?
You know, she's now about 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's not quite a year old yet.
She's
old enough to open gifts. She's old enough to start tasting things. You know, she's tasting a lot of new foods, and it's amazing to watch her eyes just open up and sparkle with everything. And she's a very good eater. She's always opening her mouth and wanting more food. So I think what's going to be so exciting is just watching her expressions and her excitement. She gets very excited and starts kicking her legs and her feet and starts making all of these high-pitched noises when she gets excited. So I think – and that – there's nothing like that. And I don't think you can understand. I never understood it until I had a child of my own.
Jada, thank you.
Thank you.
Jada De Laurentiis hosts the Food Network show Jada at Home. Her show Everyday Italian also airs on the network. Her most recent cookbook is Jada's Kitchen. The turkey is done, the pie's in the oven. Now if you could only figure out which wine to serve. Pairing the right wine with your traditional turkey dinner can add a delicious dimension to an already mouth-watering meal. And selecting the perfect variety doesn't have to be a hassle. Leslie Sobracco knows all about the vino. She's the author of Wine for Women and the Simple and Savvy Wine Guide. She's also the wine consultant for the gourmet food store, Harry and David. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Farai.
So a lot of people are completely intimidated by wine. They might be afraid they'll mispronounce the name of a region or look stupid sniffing and swirling the glass. So how do you advise people to get over their anxieties?
I tell them it's only fermented grape juice. So not to worry about it at all. It's really about enjoyment. And I think that's where we're moving in this country with wine, is to the casualization, if you will, of wine, making it an approachable everyday beverage. And you can sip it with Chinese food, or you can splurge on it with New Year's Eve meal.
So turkey is a staple of many holiday meals. So white wine, can you only drink white wine with poultry, or can you mix it up?
Absolutely not. I am of the belief that drink what you like and eat what you like and you'll be happy. But there certainly are guidelines that make things better. And when it comes to pairing food and wine, there are certainly things like matching the texture of the food and wine, about pairing up the sauces. When it comes, however, to the turkey table, that's where you get a little tricky, because it's not about the turkey, really. It's about the gravy and the spicy sausage stuffing and the yams covered in marshmallows and your grandmother's green jello and the cranberry sauce. So it's this cacophony of flavors that really are assaulting your palate, and that's what you're having to balance with the wine. So don't worry about the turkey. Worry about all the other stuff when you're pairing food and wine.
Now, what simple guidelines can you offer folks when, in general, they're trying to figure out how to pair food and wine?
Well, let's just take, for example, since the holidays are in full gear and people will be serving turkey meals, they'll be serving ham, they'll be serving roast beefs. With the turkey, things that you want to sort of stay away from are heavy Cabernet Sauvignons and Merlots, maybe really big buttery, oaky Chardonnays, because those are the kind of things that conflict with the flavors. With a turkey table meal, you're looking to help offset the tanginess of the cranberry sauce or match the sweetness of the sweet potatoes. So look for wines that have a little bit lower alcohol, maybe a little bit lower little to no oak character, have really bright, refreshing, juicy flavors and bright acidity, and have a lot of fruit flavors, and even sometimes a little bit of sweetness. And so things like white wine, you're looking for things like Riesling, which has often a touch of sweetness in it and very fresh and vibrant flavors. Things like Gewürztraminer, or just Gewürz for short, which means spiced. And it has a little bit of fleshy character to it, but it still is this lovely fruity wine with a little bit of spice to help offset that spicy sausage stuffing. And in terms of red wine, things like Beaujolais. A lot of folks drink Beaujolais with turkey because it has this fresh, again, fruity character, lots of red cherry notes, not too intimidating in terms of the alcohol levels. I love, you know, a nice balanced Syrah with a turkey meal, which is a bigger, heartier red wine. But Pinot Noir probably is your ultimate turkey table wine. It's an elegant red that has balanced characters of oak and tannin, and for that it just means a little grippy in your mouth. Pinot Noir is like a sexy silk dress, and that is really what it does, is it drapes your palate and helps to offset all the wild flavors that you're getting from turkey.
All right, Harry and David, I mean, this is a place that has these legendary gift baskets. It's really one of these stalwarts of the holiday season. So tell me about your relationship with them.
Well, I'm very excited. I do a number of consulting projects. And Harry and David came to me 6 months ago and said they were starting to launch a wine program, which is very exciting for a company that's 75 years old. And so we've launched a wine program which has about 10 offerings at this point and growing, and some terrific wines, for example, from Italy. I've got the Bracchetto di Acqui, which is a lightly sweet, sparkling red wine that's paired with chocolate, and it's just brilliant. I've got a gift basket, the Ultimate Wine Tasting Basket, which has three terrific wines from California, including Newton's Vineyards Claret from Napa, which is great, Rutherford Hill Merlot, Cuvée Saint Chardonnay, and just a huge basket full of everything you'll need to throw the great, you know, ultimate holiday wine tasting party. So I think what it means is when you get a company that's sending out 90 million catalogs a year, you know, reaching the American public to now integrate wine into that is certainly saying something about where wine is in our culture. People want it.
How did you get into this?
Drinking a lot. Pretty much. the truth. I actually came with a background in television, and I still, of course, do television. I have a television show on PBS called Check Please Bay Area. But it came from pure passion. It came from being an avid consumer of wine. And about 15 years ago, after visiting as many wineries as I could in California and beyond, making home wine, you know, I'm a home winemaker, so taking courses to make home wine and joining tasting groups, I just had an epiphany where I said, okay, I have to be able to somehow make a living talking about something I love, and wine was, you know, was it for me.
Take us out with a couple of bargains and splurges.
For the holiday meal, look for Chenin Blanc from South Africa, which is a crisp white wine. And you can look for lovely Pinotage, which is a red wine unique to South Africa, and it's sort of like Pinot Noir. And you can get those in very bargain prices. Terrific. Wines from Spain certainly offers tremendous values right now in both white and red categories. So look for Albarino, or look for Tempranillo from the Rioja region, and Toro and Ribera del Duero in Spain. Certainly wines from Australia. And everybody knows Shiraz from Australia, the spicy red. But there's also beautiful dry style Rieslings from the Clare Valley of Australia. And Argentina is my other fabulous pick for international wines that offer value. Malbec from Argentina is an ideal wine, a big red wine to go with roast beef, for example, during the holiday season. And it won't set you back a lot of money. You know, there are many wonderful producers like Catena, and they make wines for well under $10.
So, Leslie, what about some splurge wines?
Well, I think in this economy, splurge is a relative term. So what I like to do is tell people to think about makeovers. For example, if they're thinking about spending $100 on a bottle of great champagne, that's wonderful. You can go out and buy Dom Pérignon, certainly. Dom Pérignon Rosé, for example, would set you back a couple hundred dollars. But think about sort of switching that out with another wine. For example, Chandon in Napa Valley is part of the same company that produces Dom Pérignon from Moët et Chandon in France. And they do a gorgeous wine called Etoile, and it's about $40 for a sparkling wine. So now you've splurged and gotten one of California's best sparkling wines, and it's by the same company that ultimately makes Dom Pérignon. So now you've splurged, but save yourself a little Christmas money as well.
Leslie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Wine authority Leslie Sobracco is the author of Wine for Women and the Simple and Savvy Wine Guide. She's also the wine consultant for Harry and David. She spoke with us from NPR member station KQED, where she hosts the TV show Check Please. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It is time again for sports, and our very own Tony Cox is here. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, it's football on Thanksgiving. It's a decades-long tradition, and as usual, there are three games happening today, some interesting storylines as well to go along with them. So, here to give us a breakdown is News and Notes sports guru, New York Times sports columnist Mr. Bill Roden. What's up, Bill?
The great Tony Cox. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, my man. Listen, I want to get into the history of Turkey Day games briefly in a moment, but first, let's talk about the three games today. Titans and the Lions, the best and the worst. You know, why should we even watch this?
Because it's Thanksgiving, Tony. Come on, man. You got, you know. But also, and it's the American thing to do. But, you know, also, I was in Nashville the other Sunday for Titans-Jets. And I'm really curious to find out now how the Titans are going to rebound from this. Clearly, they should beat Detroit. But I don't know. It could be a little closer than you think.
I mean, I'm sure they're going to be carving up the Detroit Lions on Thursday. But all right. Also, Dallas versus Seattle, a 7-4 team taking on a 2-9 team. Again, this has the makings of a dud, doesn't it?
Yeah, so that's the game we don't have to watch. Unless you just like Seattle. So, I mean, really, you could pass on that.
It's like, watch, oh, my God. All
Oprah
right.
Oprah or something. Yeah.
Here's one that may be interesting. The Eagles taking on the Cardinals today. Cardinals coming off of that whipping over the weekend. I don't know what you'll say is the biggest storyline for this game, but I have an idea that it begins with McNabb.
Now, Donovan, there is overtime. So don't Poor Donovan. Yeah, I think you're right, Tony. This is a compelling game, probably the most compelling of all of them, just because of how the wheels are coming off. And it looks like, and if they lose this, they may send Donovan out immediately after the game.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how it turns out as we flip the dial from one station to the other this afternoon and this evening. How did the Thanksgiving Classic, by the way, come to be a classic, if you know? I mean, do you remember paying any attention to watching the game on Thursday when you were younger?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the history began somewhere with the old American Football League. But my personal history, I mean, in the Roden household, I grew up in Chicago, and it was a Thanksgiving Day ritual to watch Detroit play Green Bay. That was just what you did. I mean, that was when the black and blue division was really at its height. And that's, you know, that to me defined Thanksgiving. And to this day, I mean, every time I think of Thanksgiving, I'm thinking of Detroit playing somebody, Detroit playing Green Bay.
No, you mean Detroit losing to somebody.
Let's see, back in the day, I'm old enough to remember when Detroit actually was good. And when they actually were good, they had, you know, they actually won.
I guess that's before
your time, I know.
I suppose it is. You know, the other thing about that game, depending on what time zone you're in, it usually came on in the afternoon after you had already eaten. So you're sitting there rubbing your stomach, and what else were you going to do but watch the game?
And remember, that was before cable. I mean, you were pretty much hostage.
Well, that's absolutely true. Let me ask you about another thing, because we're into the holiday season full blast now. And our next subject deals with sports history because it's usually collected and interpreted by writers like yourself. People are going to have time for reading now, and I want to ask you about books, specifically sports books. Mm-hmm. I get the feeling, Bill Roden, that a great sports book has to be about more than sports.
I would think so. There's a story. There's a really, really good book that just came out, Tony, and it's perfect for the holiday season. It's a book called Running for My Life, My Journey in the Game of Football and Beyond. And it's by Warrick Dunn, the former Atlanta Falcon and current Tampa Bay Buccaneer running back. It really is a very good book, man. He really had a hard life. His mother was murdered. And Warrick actually met the person who's on death row who murdered his mother. And the book is sort of about redemption and growing and moving on. It really is a good holiday read.
You know, when we talk about some of the all-time sports books that have been written, I mean, some come to mind like A.J. Liebling's The Sweet Science, mm-hmm. Roger Kahn's A Boys of Summer, Bissinger's Friday Night Lights, which became a movie and a TV show, George Plimpton's Paper Lion, mm-hmm. and, of course, this Third and a Mile, Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback by, let's see, who wrote that? Hack named Bill Roden.
That's right. Yeah, who also wrote $40 Million Slaves. Since we're being shameless here on Thanksgiving.
Black authors, though, what about their books? Do they always have to be biographical?
You know, Tony, not really. I just think that the history of African Americans in this country is just so rich and so deep that I think a lot of the books, by definition, have to deal with the sociology of sport. Now, there is a really good biography out that I just got hold of. It's a book about Sam Lankford. Sam Lankford was a great boxing champion, and the book is called Sam Lankford, Boxer's Greatest Uncrowned Champion. And it really is a very compelling biography about a guy you don't really know, but for the color line, we would have heard a lot about him. But and I think that's why you have so many black authors doing books about, you know, forgotten history or little-known history.
Do you think that black books, sports books, do they stand the test of time? I'm thinking now of someone like, let's say, Arthur Ashe, mm-hmm. whose Road to Glory in three volumes was really big. I guess it's been, what, 30 years now?
It's not been that long. But I'm glad you mentioned that book, because that's one of the ones I was going to mention as a classic. And if you don't have it in your library, you really should. Hard Road to Glory, the three volumes. And also, a classic book is Harry Edwards.
The Revolt of the Black Athlete?
The Revolt of the Black Athlete is the one I suggest. A, shows you how how far we haven't come. That was sort of a groundbreaking book on the sociology of African Americans in sport. So, you know, and those two have really stood the test of time. I think 20 years from now, we'll still be talking about those books.
Well, let me just say on behalf of everybody here at News and Notes, have a happy Thanksgiving Day to you.
And on the East Coast, same to you.
Bill Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of one of the greatest sports books ever written, ever in the history of mankind. It is called Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. See you, Bill.
Take care.
On Thanksgiving Day, after the football game and the big dinner and the heated debates, it could be time to sit down and watch a movie. If you can't decide what film to watch, never fear. Film critic Ernest Hardy joins us now to tell us about some Thanksgiving classics. Hi, Ernest.
Hello, how are you?
Doing great. So what makes a good Thanksgiving family flick?
I think it's those films which sort of deal with family issues, family strife, but then end on a note of hope or uplift.
So we're going to go through a few of them. And rather than, you know, go deeper into the issue, I'm going to go ahead and start with one of the classics, 1974, Claudine. Diane Carroll, she's working under the table as a maid so she can qualify for welfare. And James Earl Jones plays a garbage man who falls in love with her. But can he deal with her cynical kids?
Hi, Sugar. Miss Claudine Price Leafy?
Yeah, who are you?
My name is Rupert B. Marshall. What's yours?
Patrice.
Patrice? Oh, yeah, like Patrice Lumumba.
No, like Patrice Price.
Yeah, right. That's a pretty name. Your mama home?
No.
Where is she?
I don't know.
You mind if I come anyway for her?
Mama said never let nobody in when she ain't home.
Well, there you go. It's the grand old rule of being a child with the key. All done, sped up. And if the kids can't keep Claudine and her love interest apart, poverty and their own past might.
Holy Christ. How'd you wind up with six kids?
Well, haven't you heard about us ignorant black bitches always got to be laying up with some dude just grinding out them babies for the taxpayers to take care of? I get $30 a piece for them kids. Oh, I'm living like a queen on welfare, you know.
You're jumpy.
Well, my kids are fine. You don't need to be worried about my kids.
Oh, no, I'm not worried about your kids. Not my problem.
That shit all the time from the welfare. Always asking me to apologize for my kids. You know what? I don't have to explain that to nobody. Now, you just pushed the wrong button.
Okay, I was just asking.
Well, not holding back.
No, not at all.
What does this movie say about how people were discussing things at the time? Is it an accurate, I mean, you know, film is always kind of either a hyped up or a stylized version of reality, but what relationship did it have to the reality of the times?
One of the reasons that I love that film is that when she falls in love with the garbage man, it not only complicates her own emotional and inner life, but it also reshapes the dynamic of her household with her children, and it also endangers her government assistance. So the film captures all of that. And it does it in a way, you know, the language, the cadence, the vocabulary of the early 70s in black film that was made then was very different than what we see now. One of the things that I love about Diane Carroll is that when she's playing this part, and it was a part that many people thought she could not play because of her own persona. You know,
her glamour.
Very glamorous and very regal and very aloof. Those qualities, when she brought them to this character, it made the character more resonant and more layered than and the expected single black mom living in a poor neighborhood. You know, because there are black women who live in poverty and who live lives of struggle that are dignified and that are classy and that are intelligent. And having Diane Carroll bring those qualities to this character, not only did it help her expand her image, but it also broadened what people thought of this kind of character.
Well, we're going to take a little bit of a leap through history. You know, you go from Claudine, 1974, and this is just a decade later, but it's culturally miles away. And every movie needs a tagline for your next pick. The tagline goes like this. The beat of the streets is the dance explosion of the 80s. Push it to pop it, rock it to lock it, break it to make it for the break of your life. What are we talking about?
Breaking.
So people who watch this film as children now are old enough to have children themselves. And what was once avant-garde is now kind of, you know, something that people look at as, you know, this playful, old school, out of date, but in a loving way.
Yeah.
You know, what role do you think it has to people now?
You know what? It's a very charming film. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I put it, you know, recommended it on the list. It's a very charming, fun film, and it reminds us that, you know, this was before gangster rap. It was before people felt that you had to have violent, blood-soaked tales from the hood in order to be authentically hip-hop. And so this is a reminder that hip-hop is much more varied and much more dynamic, and that there is a musicality and playfulness with language and with image.
All right, this one might be a little surprising for the holidays. It's all about fractured family, but, you know, redemptive. Derek Luke, Denzel Washington, also directed by Denzel. It is Antoine Fisher.
You looking for a discharge, Fisher?
I ain't looking for nothing.
That's where you headed.
If I want out of the Navy, I'll just leave.
Unauthorized absence?
Yeah, that's what the Navy calls it.
Mm-hmm. Running away how you handle your problems?
I don't have no problems.
Where'd you spend your childhood?
Cleveland.
Parents still live there?
I never had any parents.
They deceased?
I never had parents.
That would make you a medical miracle, Seaman Fisher. Where are you from?
I'm from under a rock.
Okay. All right, I'm gonna see you next week.
I ain't coming back.
Why not?
Because there's nothing wrong with me.
I agree with you there. See you next week.
There has become a whole genre of the kind of the male coming of age film, but with the psychological twist of the guy finding himself, you know, through counseling of some sort. Mm-hmm. What does this movie bring to the table?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I'm really glad that you framed it in that way, because when this film was first released, a lot of mainstream critics dismissed it as being simply cliched and simply formulaic. What this film brings to the setup that you just described is that none of the other films deal specifically with the fact that beneath so much of the rage, so much of the destruction that a subset of young black males bring to the table, beneath all of that is depression. Beneath all of that is tremendous sadness. You know, this film talks about the fact that young black boys are victims of sexual abuse and emotional abuse. That's not a common topic in any film. This is a film that says that beneath the swagger, there is a lot of dysfunction that is not the fault of the person who is doing the swaggering. And what it does even more importantly is it shows that there can still be redemption, that there can still be affirmation for the one who is victimized, for these people, for these young men who are brutalized, you know, by society, by their families, that if we don't just toss them out, if we embrace them, you know, they can be, and they still are, our family.
Now, as a final film, we have a tearjerker, Imitation of Life. Which version are you talking about?
We're talking about the great Douglas Sirk 1959 version. This is the one that has Lana Turner, Mahalia Jackson doing that amazing version of Trouble of the World, and the actress Susan Conner, who is actually not African-American, but she plays a very fair-skinned African-American character who's trying to pass for white.
Sarah Jane Johnson, you put your clothes on and get out of this place.
Say, honey, who is this character?
I don't know. Never seen her before in my life. Now quit lying. You tell me you had a respectable job in the library.
Hey, what's going on here?
Oh, she must be crazy. Tell her my name's Judy Brand. Make her go away.
Look, lady, why don't you blow?
You'd better keep out of this, mister. This girl here's my daughter. And if you don't tell her to go home with me, her mother, I'll have the law on you.
Your mother?
Now, that's some drama right there.
Absolutely.
Loyalty, skin color, culture.
Yeah, and one of the things that I always...
Dishonor.
When I talk about this film, I like to point out something that the great film historian Donald Bogle wrote when he wrote about this film, and he says that, you know, the character of Sarah Jane doesn't so much want to be white as she wants white opportunities. And I think that's a very crucial distinction to make so that she's not simply cast as a villain. She has the skin tone that, according to all of society's rules, should ensure that she's a princess. But because she's actually, quote-unquote, of, you know, African-American descent, all those doors are shut in her face. So I would like people to bring that to the table when they watch this film and not see her just as this horrible, ungrateful child turning her back on her dark-skinned mother.
I want to thank you, Ernest.
Thank you for having me.
Ernest Hardy is a film and music critic living in Los Angeles, and you can find his essays, reviews, and interviews in his books, Blood Beats, Volumes 1 and 2. He also writes the blog Blood Beats at ernesthardy.blogspot.com.
How can I work out this sweet relation? Let us build with love, keeping our hearts together with no temptation, keeping us loving, hugging and loving,
hugging and loving,
getting with the kissing,
getting with the kissing,
getting with the kissing.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.